Well, I am surrounded by three clocks. Two of them are saying that it's the bottom of the hour and time to start. Hello, everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and I'd like to welcome you to another Weber Training teleclass. Now, I had been expecting to introduce Dr. Michael Gardam and his teleclass on tuberculosis test methods, but following a string of nasty outbreaks, he was recruited by the government late last week to help investigate the hospital outbreaks and help get them resolved. We will be recording his lecture, though, and it will be made available to everyone who has registered for it, and I would invite you to stay tuned for that. I'll be telling you more in the next days and weeks as soon as we get to record it. There is a man, though, who is tremendously well-respected among his colleagues for his work in TB. He has authored a manual on the management of pediatric tuberculosis, among many other peer-reviewed publications. This man is, of course, Dr. Ian Kitai. He came highly recommended, and I'm so pleased that he's able to be with us today to give his teleclass lecture, TB in Children and Adolescents, Problems with Diagnosis and Infection Control. Now, Dr. Kitai did his medical training in South Africa, and then specialty training in the UK and in Toronto. He invested several years of his professional career working in Zimbabwe and in a Cree community in northern Manitoba, and he finally settled in Toronto, where he is a tuberculosis specialist at the Hospital for Sick Children. He's also an associate professor at the University of Toronto. I'm very pleased that he's able to make this time for us. And looking at his slides, I know that it will be very interesting, and I know that there's a lot to say, so I won't say too much more myself. To bring us to teleclass, Tuberculosis in Children and Adolescents, from the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, Canada, it's my distinct pleasure to present Dr. Ian Kitai. Ian.
Thank you. I hope you can hear me, and the introduction's much too nice, but thanks to everyone. And I understand that I'm talking to a mixed audience, many people in infection control, perhaps in public health, perhaps some clinical people. So I hope this is pitched at the right kind of level, and I hope also that what will come across is some of the uncertainties that I have in my day-to-day practice. So if we can go to the next slide after the introductory slide. One of the points that I think I want to make, because many people are more used to tuberculosis in adults, and tuberculosis is more commonly diagnosed in adults, certainly in developing countries, than it is in children. And in general in the world, that's true for a bunch of reasons. But young children with tuberculosis are different from adults. They're different in the way they present. They're different in that they are generally not infectious. And I've underlined the generally, and I want to talk to that point a little bit later. They're different in the way they go from infection to disease, and I'm sure most of or all of the audience would know that distinction. We talk about infection simply as having breathed in tubercle bacilli, and those bacilli being lodged somewhere in your body, usually a little part of your lung. An infection generally is latent. The bacilli go to sleep, are walled off by host defenses, whereas disease is disease at any site. The problem with young children is they may progress to disease much more quickly than do adults. They do so more often than do adults, and more of that disease is not simply pulmonary disease, but more of it is extrapulmonary. They also may differ from adults in the ways they respond to treatment. I may be able to illustrate that. They may respond as well or better. They may also perhaps have more what are called immune reconstitution problems, where they seem to get worse while on therapy. And there may be differences in the side effect profile for some of the medications we use. And I suppose the big point I want to make, I'll make it immediately, is generally isoniazid in particular is much better tolerated by young children than it is by old people. If you go to the next slide, one of the things we've discovered over the past few years is adolescents with TB are also different. They may present differently. They There's often a delay in diagnosis, and usually it's not the adolescent's fault, it's the health service's fault. And we have, as with adolescents everywhere, more compliance issues and probably mood disorders. So I want to move to the next slide, which is entitled Case 1, and it's something I throw out for people to think about. He has a four-year-old who presented to an outside hospital with a pneumonia that just didn't clear up after about 2 weeks of therapy. He was a child born in an endemic country, but had come to Canada at the age of one and then presented with fever and a chest infiltrate. And the chest x-ray showed hilar lymphadenopathy, which I'll try and illustrate is a problem, and a small infiltrate. A diagnosis of a pulmonary TB was suspected, and the clinician very appropriately went ahead and got gastric aspirates from that child on three successive mornings, put them straight into a buffered kit, which is very important to get hold of. The Ontario province provides a GL kit, which has sodium carbonate in the bottom of it to try and take out some of the acidity because the acid fast bacilli will actually die quite quickly. And so the diagnosis is now made. This child has culture positive TB with a chest infiltrate. And the general questions are, what should happen to the junior kindergarten class that he attends? And should there be contact screening, and what is its purpose? So to try and answer that, there is a standard response. And the problem with TB is we often have our very stock responses because these are operationally driven things where you're trying to think about large numbers of people generally in highly endemic countries. And I think in more developed countries or in better resourced countries, we need to have some nuances in that response. What's the standard response? The standard response is young children, approximately less than 10, and I want to make the point that age is not the issue here, it's more the way they present, do not spread TB to others. Generally, childhood tuberculosis in young children is porcine bacillary. That is, there are very few bacteria in the lesions you find, be they lymph nodes or the small parenchymal lesion you might find. So this is not the great big cavity that you see in an adolescent or an adult filled with millions or billions of TB organisms. And the second point is that generally children do not generate the kinds of coughs that make those fine aerosols that will spread TB as an airborne infection all over the place. And so the standard response is there's little role for isolation in pediatric TB. And I think this message is largely true, and it's important every day. This morning in clinic, I had the same concern about a four-year-old. Can my child play with other children? And the point I wanted to make and will make again is don't worry about your child. Worry about the adults around the child. There are a few exceptions, however, where children have transmitted TB to at least a few people, and I want to go through those exceptions. So if you can move on to the next slide, it says who infects children, and on the left-hand side you'll see an x-ray of an adolescent we managed some years ago with good left upper lobe disease, cavitary disease, smear numerous, stayed smear positive for a long time. And the famous slide on the right of a cough showing those aerosols being generated that would spread TB. And so the children catch TB from adults or from adolescents, and typically these are people with multibacillary and cavitary disease and cough. Less often, and we learned this from our Marcel Baer study in San Francisco, smear negative, culture positive patients do account for a chunk of TB transmission in a community, so don't ignore the smear negative culture positive patients. But if you go to the next slide, young children have rarely spread TB to others. So there's a three-month-old who recently published in the International Journal of Tuberculosis and Lung Disease, who had spread tuberculosis to parents and to close healthcare workers. This child, I will show you the slide of shortly, but had extensive disease and then moved the TB to other healthcare workers. But the child had a cavitary disease, and it was multibacillary, and a harsh cough, which were exceptional circumstances. And so these are two examples on the next slide of where children have been infectious. The first, at the top, is a 9-year-old, and the article was published in the New England Journal in 1999, a 9-year-old who originated from the Solomon Islands, I believe, but was in an unlikely place, was in, I believe, a Midwest state, in a rural part of a Midwest state, and ended up infecting 3/4 of his household, 10 out of 32 bus riders, and he had a long bus ride to school, and 16 out of 24 classroom contacts. You'll notice if you look at that x-ray closely that there were two large cavities there. There's a cavity in the right lower lobe and a cavity in the left upper lobe. And this child essentially has adult-type multibacillary cavitary disease. The other child we described was the 3-month-old who's in the lower right corner who has very extensive miliary disease. And a cavity which you can probably make out just adjacent to the right heart border. And this child ended up infecting a nurse who was in very close contact with the child for a night, an ambulance, a paramedic who traveled down with this child on a 1.5-hour ambulance ride, and both parents. And these were real, true conversions with very large, more than 15-millimeter Mantoux test. The parents, we didn't have prior recordings, the others we did. The point I want to make is both of these children, irrespective of age, had multibacillary disease with cavities. And so based on not these arbitrary age cutoffs, but the nature of the disease, we could pretty much predict that they would be infectious. The other point is the small child, the 3-month-old, had a particularly harsh cough, which may have helped transmission. But as I've said, if you move to the next slide, the real issue with infection control and TB, and I am somewhat maverick perhaps in saying this, but the real issues don't have anything to do with the children. So who does pose infectious risks in TB? And here's a study that was in ICHE in 2002 and comes from Jeffrey Stark's group at Texas Children's, where they screened consecutive adult visitors of 59 children admitted with tuberculosis. Isolation was used if the TB was judged by the criteria we sort of talked about, if it was thought to have the potential to be airborne. 8 of those 59 children were isolated, the rest weren't. But, interestingly, about 15% of adult visitors coming to see these children had previously undetected pulmonary TB. And certainly we've tried to make it a policy that if we admit a child to SickKids right now, and they're the index case, we will x-ray both parents at the time we evaluate and try and admit that child to at least rule out that they don't have obvious infectious TB. So in fact, we focus on the child, and transmission from children is rare, but certainly not impossible. However, the main risk is from the adults accompanying the child. Now actually, just as I was leaving for work this morning in the most recent edition of the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, there's an article from Montreal that looks at 66 children who had screening by public health to look at the yield and molecular epidemiology and its contribution. But one of the issues is that, you know, how frequently will you find a case? We always say that a new case of pediatric TB is a sentinel event, and it means somewhere in the community there's someone who has TB. This may be not as frequent in a place like Toronto, where a lot of our children acquire their TB in the country of origin as a latent infection and may then develop TB disease later. But it's certainly, and the same would be true in Montreal, but still out of approximately 60 children that they covered, they found four new infectious adults. And that, for me, is a very significant number, because those people are certainly at high risk of spreading their TB to other people. So if you go back to the next slide, which says case one, the four-year-old with the unresolving pneumonia, should the class be screened? No. The only time I would think about investigating that class, this child did not have infectious TB, and I don't have his x-ray to show you, but he had a small infiltrate. He had mainly hilar nodes. This was basically cultured from gastric aspirates. The child really doesn't pose a risk particularly. But once on treatment, should the child be kept from the class? No. Our typical rule of thumb for anyone is if they smear negative, and definitely smear negative, we wait at least 2 weeks before they are allowed back to school. If they smear positive, and this is true for older kids, based on Dick Menzies' work in Montreal and others, we would normally wait for them to turn smear negative plus 2 weeks. That may keep them out of school for a good length of time. But there's no data to really support that simply 2 weeks of therapy, even if it's appropriate therapy, is sufficient to make you non-infectious if you are an adolescent with multibacillary disease. And so I'll come back to that. Should there be contact screening, and what's its point? Well, in my view, yes, it is important. It should happen rapidly, and it's mainly to identify the infectious adults around that child, and getting them treated and, if necessary, isolated is the most important part of the exercise. In fact, in this particular child, a maternal aunt was, a few weeks later, found to have infectious pulmonary TB. And so this was truly a sentinel event. The aunt was identified. Thankfully, people jumped on this quickly, and she's doing well, and the child's been really taken off therapy now after 6 months, and we're very happy with that outcome. So I hope that deals with some of the infection control issues we face in certainly childhood TB. The bottom lines are it's rare for children to transmit disease, but don't forget about the adults and think about them as you admit patients. So the next slide illustrates that most children are not infectious. Exceptions are cavitary disease, multibacillary disease, and cough, irrespective of age. And remember the adults. How do we see, certainly in North America, pediatric and adolescent TB? Well, a good chunk of what we see is detected through contact screening, through the efforts of, I believe, many of the people who may be on the line right now. In Ontario, we can say now about 20% of pediatric TB, pediatric and adolescent TB, and probably a bigger percentage of pediatric TB, is found through contact screening. These are typically well children who look fine and have no symptoms. They're identified as a result of finding an infectious adult. One does an x-ray, and the x-ray turns out to be abnormal. We have a second population, certainly here in Toronto, who present with disease at any site. These are typically children who've come to Toronto from high-incidence countries. They may have been latently keeping their infection in check, and suddenly will then develop disease. And I'll show you some examples of that as time goes on. The next slide shows what's happened to TB in Canada, and overall, TB rates within Canada have dropped to well under 10 per 100,000 per year in terms of incidence rates. But there are pockets where that is not true. It's not true if you go to the next slide for Aboriginal Canadians. Should the class B screened, got pasted there, I apologize, it shouldn't be there. But this also illustrates from the 1970s through to 2000, Canadian-born non-Aboriginal peoples, this isn't just pediatric, have accounted for less and less tuberculous disease. There is unfortunately still a reasonable amount of TB disease amongst Canadian-born Aboriginal Canadians. And the foreign-born are an increasing source of tuberculosis for us. They're also a source of our vitality and strength as a country with new immigrants. But we have to bear in mind that we need to screen, we need to look hard, and we need to help treat appropriately those who come latently infected. So I think most people online, whether if you go to the next slide, are used to the definitions. Latent TB infection is kind of a hypothetical construct. We believe there are a few bacilli sequestered somewhere, walled off by the host defenses, and not detected clinically. Practically, this means a child who is well with a normal exam and a normal chest x-ray, but who has a positive test for latent TB infection. And the test we've known for too many years, perhaps, is the Mantoux test, and it's still the best or most standardized test where we have newer tests like the QuantiFERON Gold and the T-SPOT are licensed in adults are coming our way, and one of our tasks will be to try and work out how useful they are. TB disease means signs or symptoms at any site. If you go to the next slide, I want to go through these steps one at a time, and you may want to focus on each line as we go along. What happens when a child is exposed to TB? There's an adolescent or adult at home coughing away, and what are the consequences? Well, one of the first consequences may be no infection. That is, the child looks well. We do a skin test at the time the infectious adult is identified. We do a skin test 3 months later, and we find that the skin test stays negative, and if that child's followed for a long period of time, does not seem to develop disease. And so no infection is quite common. It always surprises me when a family of eight turns up in clinic and we only ultimately find two or three children are infected despite a highly infectious adult. And there may be many reasons, including some related to genetic differences in macrophage function and T-cell function and other factors as to why you don't get infected. But no infection does happen, and happens quite often. The second thing that may happen is that the child may acquire some TB bacilli in a small part of the lung, together with some lymph nodes in the lung. And this is the so-called primary complex, which I'll illustrate just now. Most of the time, if a child gets a primary complex, this heals. And the child goes on with latent infection. And some of those children will reactivate sometime in their lifetime, perhaps in adolescence, perhaps when they're very old. In some people, the primary complex may progress. That's the left side of this. And the progression would mean those nodes, which are sitting at the hilum of the lungs, may expand, may erode into the bronchus, may cause a pneumonia, may cause wheezing. That's not common, but it's certainly one of the ways we see young children with symptoms. The other two lines are important, that is TB meningitis and miliary TB. They're important not because they are very common, but because they're often devastating. And the problem with young children is they more often go on to those features. So if I can go to the next slide, we're talking about TB in the very young, and we're going back to the three-month-old who I, and this is by no means the only three-month-old I have on file, but I think this child illustrates very well what might happen. This child presented with what was thought to be pertussis to an outside hospital. He'd had a fever for a while and a cough. He was Canadian-born, which was part of the bugbear, and he was unwell. And in fact, if you look at his x-ray, which is the next slide, you can see the extensive miliary disease he had. He had hemophagocytosis. He required ventilation and ICU admission. He was critically ill for a long, long time. And it turns out that he was quite immunocompetent. There's nothing wrong with this child's immune system. The problem is his age. And this illustrates, and he acquired the TB, in fact, during a previous visit to another hospital for short-term ventilation. And so here was a child who was simply exposed to a strain of TB. Within 3 months, he had developed life-threatening disease. And And so I need that to be borne in mind. And that's what may well happen in the very young child who gets TB. Most miliary disease, if you look at the South African literature, happens under 6 months of age. Here's another problem for the very young. So if you go to the next slide, which says TB in the young, here's a three-year-old who had presented with 6 weeks of fever and lethargy and weight loss, and unfortunately we've had a similar older child just who I reviewed today. You can see the hydrocephalus evidence on the CT scan with some leptomeningeal enhancement, that's those sort of white areas around the leptomeninges. On chest x-ray, there is a paratracheal node, which the arrow is illustrating to you. This child turned out to have tuberculous meningitis. And in many ways, the child did well. There was the child went from coma to sitting to walking reasonably well. The child had cranial nerve defects, including strabismus, which improved, had some motor deficits that improved. It was too early when I did the slide to know what would happen to cognition. The problem with TB meningitis, many other forms of TB, we can bring the child back to normal. TB meningitis is one where permanent sequelae are very common. And so if you go to the next slide, TB we worry about in the very young because they can quickly go to TB disease. It's often disseminated. It may be miliary or develop TB meningitis. And if a very young child is exposed, the younger the child, the more urgent is the need for prophylaxis. It's frequent in our clinic that we're sent, for instance, a newborn who's been exposed to an infectious adult case, and the parents say, yeah, we understand the child needs prophylaxis. Can't we wait till the child's a bit older? And I have to say, absolutely, this is the time that you have to give prophylaxis when the child is very young because they're at greatest risk for getting sick. And so what do we do with young children who've been in contact with TB? If you go to the next slide, we would x-ray all children. We would not rely on the PPD because especially in children under 6 months, the PPD is not reliable. And the other point is we always do the PPD as a baseline at the time of break-in contact, but it can take up to 3 months for that skin test to turn positive. For children who are PPD negative and clinically well, we would give preventive treatment, so if it's an INH-sensitive strain, it would be INH, to all children less than 5 years of age. And in some jurisdictions, that's less than four, and in some, it's less than six. But it's based on data that shows that certainly children under 4 years of age have this higher propensity to go on to get disease and more serious disease. So we're giving them prophylaxis before we know whether they're infected or not. And 3 months later, after the break in contact, we will repeat the skin test because that's the one that really is telling us whether this child was infected. If the skin test is negative, we would typically discontinue the prophylaxis. And if it's positive, and remember for a close contact, a positive test is anything above 5 millimeters. And so, and some would say equal to 5 millimeters. We need to reevaluate that child and to treat that child for latent TB infection if there is no disease. If there's disease, we have to go on to treat for disease. The next slide is data probably known to many of you. The risk factors for progressive tuberculosis disease include extremes of age, especially under four. Remember that you don't need to have HIV infection. You don't need to be immunosuppressed. Under four is immunosuppression enough. You're more likely to get disease if you've converted within the first 2 years. If we have the luxury of knowing that, you're more likely to get disease if you're HIV positive. And then there are a number of other things. More recently, the anti-TNF agents such as infliximab or etanercept, which have been associated with aggressive unusual disease. If you go to the next slide, the other point I want to make is what are the clinical features of TB disease? And the standard medical student response is fever, night sweats, and weight loss. And I want to make the point that for most childhood TB, none of that holds. Most children with TB disease may be asymptomatic or present in odd ways. So at the time of exposure, there are normally no clinical features. And then we talked about the primary reaction that the young child, and we're talking about young children here, may have with a small parenchymal lesion and a regional node. And usually those children have no features. You listen to their chest and they're fine, they're not wheezy, they don't have a cough. You x-ray them and the x-ray is abnormal. If you go to the next slide, here was an 8-year-old who was sent to us as a close contact of someone with TB and had a positive skin test. The chest x-ray was actually called normal, but if you look sort of hard at the left hilum, sort of just above the heart shadow, you may see a little bit of a bulge, and we had a suspicion about that and went on to a CT, something I probably would not do today because we have more concern about the radiation doses associated with that CT. But the next slide is a very pretty picture of the GON complex or the primary complex. You can see a small parenchymal infiltrate in that child, and this is classical primary TB, and it's labeled as such, together with a regional node in the hilum. And if you look at that node, it is actually sitting very close to the left mainstream bronchus, and it tells you what could happen. It doesn't usually, but what could happen to give that child symptoms. If that node gets much bigger, it's going to squeeze down on that bronchus, and the child may develop unilateral wheezing. Or it may erode into the bronchus, causing a segmental pneumonia as it spreads down the bronchus to the lung below. And the next slide, which shows hilar lymphadenopathy as a hallmark of primary TB, kind of re-illustrates this. And the next slide is a lateral view. And generally, we recommend lateral views because you can see the hilum quite well. And you see that golf ball sitting at the hilum, which are a series of nodes in that area. The next slide is actually lifted. It's not my own, but shows segmental pneumonia as the result of bronchial obstruction. And what can happen as well, the next slides, which may be difficult to visualize, show one of the things we talked about, that is children may get worse while on therapy. We knew this child had sensitive disease. We cultured the strain, started therapy, and the child got much worse with wheeze and stridor. And the arrow is pointing to lymph node groups that are now compressing the trachea. This child required systemic prednisone in addition to anti-TB treatment. We certainly wouldn't use it without, to try and deal with the host inflammatory response, which was making things worse, and did very well ultimately. And didn't need a lot of prednisone, in fact. So there are some principles of managing TB. You need to protect yourself and to protect and others around you. Remember the parents accompanying the child. Try to get the child into a room. Try and push for environmental controls in the institutions you're managing these children. I believe Centenary is on the line and knows my own view that there's never enough negative pressure in the world, and there's never enough isolation rooms, but the more the better. You need a few, and they're not for the child so much. They help. It's always, in my view, better to institute isolation quickly and then remove it. Having said that, the child themselves, with the kind of primary TB I showed you, does not need isolation. The other point is that in managing TB in 2006, we have to be mindful of increasing levels of resistance, including multi-drug resistance and now XDR, the extensively drug-resistant TB that was came into the news recently through the Tegela Ferry in South Africa experiences and is a worldwide problem. So we like to, if we're dealing with TB contacts, we really have to chase after the contact strain. We really want to know what are the sensitivities of the adult, the TB in that adult who you're seeing the child as a contact of. We go on to gastric aspirates, which are as good or better than bronchoscopy or bronchoalveolar lavage, as long as they're done well. We have material if people need to get it, and perhaps Paul can email me if people are interested in it. But Anne Loeffler, L-O-E-F-F-L-E-R, through the Francis Curry Center, which is you can certainly look up on the internet, has done wonderful videos and talks on how to obtain gastric aspirates, and I would recommend that anyone thinking about it should look at those. We try and get sputum where possible. We get biopsies wherever possible. And we do not rely on empiric treatments in 2006 because we can't predict sensitivities of the strain that we're going to be treating. Now, is a skin test helpful to diagnose disease? It's important to know that that about 10% of children with TB disease may be skin test negative. Here's a 14-month-old who was referred to me actually in an outside context because of persistent fever and cough and had a 4-week history of the same and was Canadian-born and visited East Africa 3 months, that should not be 3 months, it was about 2 months previously and really had nothing very significant on X-ray to find and a chest X-ray that was reported normal. The MANTU, however, was 22 millimeters, and I think this is one of these clear, what's going on situations. He has a Canadian-born child who has not had BCG, who has a prolonged fever. So there are two good reasons to do a MANTU test, and you always have to say, why are we doing the MANTU test before you do it? If you don't have a good reason, don't do it because you won't know what to do with the result. But here were two good reasons. One was an explained prolonged fever. So the question was, could this be TB disease? And the second was a visit to a highly endemic country. So there were two good reasons to do a MANTU test. And the result is very significant. We can debate the threes and fives and eights and even tens sometimes. But this was a big, almost blistering reaction suggesting something was going on. Based on that, I went ahead with gastric aspirates. We put them immediately in this sodium carbonate kit, and one of out of three actually was positive for Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which was fully sensitive. Child did very well on therapy, and grandmum in East Africa was, after a fair amount of anger and denial and various other things, actually found to have pulmonary TB and did well on treatment. So that was a kind of happy outcome. But that's one situation where a MANTU test is helpful. Often we have a lot of background noise with MANTU testing, but a non-BCG Canadian-born child in whom you're looking for to explain unusual symptoms and where there's the right epidemiological history, it is a helpful contributor to diagnosis. I showed the next slide, which is the type of drug resistance in Canada. Now, this is all of Canada for 2003. The figures for Ontario are typically much higher. That INH resistance, I believe, is 10 or 14%, and resistance to any drug is much higher. And it will depend very much on where that patient has originated. So what can we do in the way of diagnostic tests in childhood TB? If you look at the next slide, gastric aspirates we've talked about. Chest X-rays are important. We rejected this in our clinic here. A good 30 to 50% of chest X-rays taken on the outside in young children. In the children over 12, it's probably fine. But many outside places, especially in my experience, private outside facilities do not have the right equipment. They do not have pigistats. There are poor inspirations. There's often rotation of the child. They often are using doses that are too big, and so you basically get an X-ray of the spine. And technique is very important. And one of the things that TB treatment and disease in childhood is not, as I say, rocket science, but one of the things we can offer here and should be offered in your regions is good pediatric radiology. That is good technique in taking those X-rays and hopefully good interpretation because both of those things are crucial. A poor inspiration can be easily overread as hilar lymphadenopathy. A rotated film can be read as such or read as normal when there was something. We've talked about CTs and we limit our CTs now to very specific situations. The question of an X-ray abnormality, for instance, in someone who's an MDR contact, we would really want to know if there's disease or not, and we think that the risks of the CT are less than the benefits of the information that we'd get from it. And skin tests need two healthcare workers or very skilled healthcare worker in the very young child. The MANTU test is still the test we've got. It's intradermal. We're putting 200 antigens in there, but it still is the best test we've got. You need to discard that vial after 1 month. You need to have the bevel up. You need to make sure it's intradermal with a nice bleb, with a nice wheel. Get someone to hold the arm still. Newer tests in the next slide are coming. I think Mike Garden was going to talk to this, and his talk is following. They're intuitively tests we'd really like to have because they use antigens that are not found in BCG or in Mycobacterium bovis. So one would hope that a positive test would not be influenced by BCG. Most of you would know, we would disregard the history of prior BCG in interpreting skin tests in North America. That's really partly because we have no way of knowing one way or the other, and because there's reasonable data that most children lose reactivity within a year to 3 years of having BCG. Certainly BCG at birth. The people who've had repeated BCGs make life much more difficult. The newer tests avoid two visits and the lack of standardization. They don't seem great for detecting disease, and there is not enough pediatric data, and hopefully there will be more. So to get to a summary slide, childhood TB is usually Porci bacilli. This is the next slide. It's usually non-infectious. There is a spectrum going from Porci bacilli, just a few bacilli, as in that GON complex that I showed you on the CT, to multibacillary disease. There is a distinction between latent infection and disease. It's basically there's a spectrum of some bacteria, more bacteria, and more bacteria. The more bacteria there are, the more we need more than one drug to prevent resistance and to obtain cure. So we'll go on to the next slide, and again, I'm going to have to ask you to follow this carefully. And this talks about what happens after exposure. We've mentioned some of the arrows on the left. You can get no infection, or you can get the primary complex. We dealt with those. But often at the time of the primary complex, the bacilli disseminate to the lung apices, to the meninges, to the bone, to the spine, to lymph nodes, all over the body. Occasionally in young children, those areas rapidly progress to disease and we find disease there. More often they don't, and the bacteria are just walled off in those areas and remain latent, but they can reactivate. And the next series of slides will show you where some of the examples we have of what happens with reactivation at different ages. So if you look to the next slide, Miller gave us, through observational studies of the natural history of disease in children, a good timeline of when you're going to develop disease. So from the point of infection, if you look at the bottom there, within about 3 months, you may get meningitis and disseminated or miliary disease. By 4 or 5 months, you get more and more hypersensitivity, meaning more and more florid reactions to your tuberculin. Lung parenchymal and no lymph node disease may happen anywhere from 4 months on, as may pleural disease from infection. Renal and skeletal disease typically doesn't happen for at least a year. So when we see someone with TB spine, it usually means this was something acquired a year or 2 years or 10 years before. If you go to the next slide, here was a 17-year-old who'd had pain and weight loss and fever for about a year, and it turns out if you look at his tibia to have, and a bit of his femur to have a moth-eaten part of his tibia, and it was diagnosed as an avascular necrosis, and he had a weight loss of 35 pounds, and he was thought to be depressed, and he was sent to adolescent medicine here, which was a good thing because an experienced clinician took one look at him and sent him for a chest x-ray. And he did have a history when you got it out of him of a cough for some months. And certainly he has bilateral upper lobe disease, if you're looking at the slide with the x-ray. And the CT shows that trion bud appearance, and the CT was not really necessary. I think people were worried about tumor when they began investigating him, together with a nice cavity. It's important to look at that cavity because it makes you remember that why we have to treat some of these people for months and months for them to turn smear negative. There are bacilli stuck in that cavity. The only way you can get your drugs to that cavity are through the bloodstream, and that cavity does not have blood supply. The next slide shows someone who the neurosurgeons were investigating for metastatic brain disease, except it wasn't. It was, thankfully for him, TB, and he's done very well. The next slide is another form of tuberculoma. The slide on the left shows that just the edema at presentation, and in fact, the one on the right shows what happens when that child was given contrast, and suddenly the tuberculoma lit up, showing why there was all this edema all around, and she did very well. The next slide shows a child who had a year of backache, had seen many practitioners, and by the time of investigation, you will notice that the whole vertebra, you can generally see a disc space followed by a vertebra, followed by a disc space, followed by a vertebra, and then suddenly you get a disc space, and that whole vertebra has gone. It's collapsed, it's moved all over the place. Thankfully, he did not get neurologic complications. He's left with a little bit of a spine deformity, not very noticeable, but this was TB of the spine. The next child has a bulge in his sternum, which you may see on that x-ray, and he turned out to have multifocal osseous TB. And the final slide gets back to what is called typical TB, and one of the points I want to make is that everyone's looking, again, for fever, weight loss, and night sweats, and they don't always happen even in adolescence. This kid did have all of those, and hemoptysis, had upper lobe disease, but don't always expect it. And the next slide will show the cavity he was left with at the end of treatment. The next slide is a very important illustration. That is, here's a child who had an adolescent who had a cough for 3 months. He came to Canada 4 years previously, saw the family doctor at the onset of the cough, and had several courses of antibiotics, macrolides, amoxicillin, and I believe may have had a fluoroquinolone, and it's one of the important things not to use if you don't know there's TB, because of course fluoroquinolones have some anti-tuberculous effect, may make you feel a tiny bit better, but you should not be using monotherapy. Then finally a sputum was sent, and it was smear numerous and AMTD positive. What was the catch here? Well, one of the catches, I guess, if you look at that x-ray carefully, is that the upper lobes are spared. And most people looking for adolescent or adult reactivation TB are looking for upper lobe disease. One of the clinicians who trained me in Southern Africa gave me a good aphorism, which is, if you're looking for bilateral upper lobe or even unilateral upper lobe disease, you're being greedy. That airspace disease in the right epidemiologic context should be assumed to be TB until proven otherwise. And the simple thing to do, the thing that would have been done in a developing country, would have been to take the sputum and smear it. And the diagnosis could have been made quite quickly. It's always easy to look with a retrospectoscope, but we find that our adolescents take a long time to diagnose. April Cam, one of our residents here, did a review, and it took around 5.5 months on average, with a range of a year or more, for adolescents to be diagnosed with their TB. And it wasn't for want of going to doctor after doctor. It was just because of lack of clinical suspicion. Interestingly, this child had previously been evaluated for a positive MANTU and a normal chest x-ray, had worried that her positive MANTU, which was quite a significantly positive MANTU, was because of BCG, and so did the clinicians advising her. She decided not to take INH. The next slide illustrates a few points in adolescent TB. Here was a 14-year-old who actually had TB peritonitis. The first x-ray, actually, you can see the lungs are kind of squashed, and they're squashed because he's got a lot of ascites. But in fact, he started getting better on treatment, and then he specifically requested intermittent treatment. And after 4 months, on the next slide, he developed new infiltrates. And when we checked with public health, in fact, he was missing 50% of his directly observed therapy visits. We read the Riot Act. We threatened to section him. We instituted daily observed therapy. We added 2 extra drugs to the regimen, and he was much improved after a month. And certainly, I think compliance had been a problem there. Directly observed therapy, there's a big debate about. In my view, looking after adolescents and children with TB, it's very helpful. Part of what we have is great cooperation with Toronto Public Health and now with other public health authorities, and they are also our eyes and ears as we manage these children. They will tell us about side effects. They will help pick things up. And a recent study by Cameron Cohen, and Mike Godham is the senior author on that one, which was in the Canadian Medical Association Journal in the last couple of months, really shows that directly observed therapy was associated with survival. And I think it is. I'm very... So the next slide is a summary slide. TB in adolescence is often infectious. Late diagnosis is usually because of a lack of clinical suspicion. It's protean with a lot of extrapulmonary disease. It often happens in recent immigrants, especially in the first 5 years of coming. Mood disorders and compliance issues are common. The next two slides I'll ask you to skip over, the children with an adolescence with, because we've been over that material. And the next slide as well I'd skip over. I'm going to talk to a little bit about treatment. So the next slide that says TB disease Rx, certainly in 2006, we generally begin with at least four drugs, including ethambutol. I'm not going to get into treatment issues in great detail. For young children, we would use ethambutol, but just at 15, that is 1.5 milligrams per kilo, where optic neuritis is uncommon. For young children, I always recommend a baseline creatinine because unexplained optic neuritis or has often been associated with renal disease. Ethambutol is excreted by the kidneys. So I will just talk a moment about disease. You need to prove it susceptible, assume it to be somewhat resistant. The next slide is our board of TB medications in children, and certainly our hospital now makes a pyrazinamide suspension, but it gives you an idea of what we have. Isoniazid comes in 50s, 100s, 300s. Rifampin comes in 150s, 300s, and a suspension. Pyrazinamide as tablets, though, here we've got a suspension. Ethambutol, you've either got to go to 400s or 100s. And I'm not going to get into second-line therapy. I've mentioned DOT on the next slide and things like Docetz. The next child's sensitivities, and you'll know this is highly resistant. It's resistant to rifampin, isoniazid, and pyrazinamide. This was a child with lymph adenitis. And if you go to the next slide, I'm mentioning this in passing. What do we do in terms of monitoring children on therapy? Well, if they're on regular therapy with INH and rifampin, we do not routinely do liver functions, but we warn the parents that if there is any anorexia, nausea, vomiting, or jaundice, we stop the medication for a day or two, no longer get an AST and ALT, and if they're normal, we generally would continue. And we give vitamin B6 to, if you're getting INH, to people on milk and meat deficient diets and breastfed infants. My next slide relates to the problems of managing drug-resistant TB. And this was a child I inherited, but I always think there, but for the grace of someone, I could be. And here's his hearing aid, and it's to let us remember that we deal with some very toxic drugs. And injectables like amikacin, streptomycin, difficult to get hold of, are good drugs, excellent drugs for TB, but have horrible side effects potentially. We do weekly creatinine ureas and trough amikacin levels. We use PIC lines for amikacin observation. And we're very careful about monitoring. And I believe that does make a difference. We also quickly go to three times weekly. We do Ishihara plate testing, if you look at the next slide, for ethambutol toxicity in the clinic. So I'm going to spend the last few minutes talking about screening. Just to make a few general points, and the main point I want to look to is two-step testing, which is a bit of the bane of my life. Why do we screen for TB? Who should we screen, and how should we screen, and what should we do with the results? Well, as for the next slide, why do we screen? We screen for latent TB infection because many contacts and children from high-incidence countries are infected. And the second reason we screen are because there's a high risk of progressive disease in the very young, and we've talked about that, that young children can quickly go on to disease. It's estimated that around 10% of latent TB infection can become disease over a lifetime, and this becomes the next generation of infectious adults. We also know that for sensitive in an era of INH-sensitive disease, INH for 9 months reduces your risk of developing active disease over a lifetime by 75% or better. If you look at who to screen, the most important point there, I think, is don't screen low-risk populations. We don't have a gold standard for latent TB infection. There's nothing to show us a few bacilli sequestered somewhere in the body. We assume that this test would have a false positive and false negative rate. And even if you think the specificity and sensitivity of this test for latent infection is 95%, it really depends on the prevalence of TB in the community you are testing as to whether you're going to get a chunk of false positives or mainly true positives. So if there's a 20% prevalence of TB in your community, then then that test will have an 83% positive predictive value. Whereas if there's a 0.5% prevalence of TB in the community, then then 81%, sorry, that should read 91%, 91% of those tests are going to be false positive tests. So who should we screen? Well, the most important people to screen are close contacts of people with infectious TB. We also talk about screening people originating from high prevalence countries or have been there, and we'll go through some of the others. You do need to measure in duration if you're using the MAN2 test, flipping to the next slide. I'm not going to go through the next three slides, which really talk about the American definitions, and I realized I was speaking to more than just Canada, for what a positive test is. Practically anyone coming from an endemic country who has more than 10 millimeters is regarded positive. Practically anyone with more than 5 millimeters who's a close contact is positive. If you have someone who's thought to be latently infected, so if you can go to the slide that says TB management, LTBI, the first thing to do is exclude disease. That is, be careful physical examination, a good chest x-ray, make sure there's no disease. You're doing the child a disservice if you are going to give the child one drug for TB disease because they may well become resistant to that single drug. We use INH 10 milligrams per kilo if they have latent infection. If their source case is INH resistant, then I would refer, typically if it's rifampin sensitive, we would give 6 months, and I will always plead for directly observed preventive therapy because rifampin is the best drug we've got for treating TB, and we don't want to blow it on someone who's not taking it regularly. And we talked about liver function tests not being routine. So I want to go to two-step testing, and I think that will be probably where I'll ring off. Why do two-step tests? I often ask people that. There are very, in my view, and again, I may be maverick, and there are probably people on the line jumping up and down saying he's wrong. And the point about two-step testing is really only to know your true baseline. That is the only point. The idea is hypersensitivity wanes with time. You've been infected with TB. Your hypersensitivity with TB wanes with time. You do a skin test many years after you've been infected, and that may even be negative, but you've put in purified protein derivative into the child's arm or the adult's arm, hopefully, and this test may boost reactivity, meaning that a subsequent test will be positive. That is, the little bit of PPD jogs the immune system, more T cells then proliferate, and next time your body sees the same antigens, you'll react much more vigorously and much more quickly. And the idea is to avoid a boosted reaction interpreted as a new infection. So if you go to the next line, TB screening, two-step testing is, in my view, indicated only for the initial test of adults who will be retested periodically. For instance, a healthcare worker. If the first test is negative, you do a second test 1 to 3 weeks later. That can't be positive because of sudden exposure. It's much more likely to be positive because you had some immune memory. And so the positive second test is a boosted reaction, not a conversion. This has some importance because if it's a true conversion, especially after, say, a drug-resistant case, you're much more worried about what's going to happen to that healthcare worker. But we have very little data on what it means only to be positive on the second step of a two-step test. The data for the usefulness of INH prophylaxis in people who are latently infected is based on a first step test only. And it's always difficult to know what to advise people who are positive only on the second step of a two-step test. So if you go to the next slide, some problems with two-step testing. My first point is there is almost no place for two-step testing. That means 2 weeks apart in childhood. Children should not have to be periodically retested like healthcare workers. They're not likely to be re-exposed to TB unless they have a teacher or someone. They're not going to catch it from their junior kindergarten classroom or anything. Do not confuse this with retesting that child who's been clearly exposed to an infectious case 3 months after the break in contact. That's simply, that's not two-step testing. That's testing 3 months after break in contact, and that's very important. But don't do two-step testing just cause. There are very few data on the significance of a test positive only on step two. Dick Menzies has suggested to us that there's a good correlation with prior BCG and less correlation with two true infection. It's difficult to know what to do. Do not go retesting just to see if we can make it positive, because we won't know what to do with that result. And don't do two-step testing more than once. It should really be done once in a lifetime, in my view. And after that, if you're doing periodic testing, the testing should be a single test. So finally, how do you evaluate a child? We take a history of a TB contact. We look for a BCG scar, but we generally ignore it in North America. We do a weight and height. We look for alertness. And some of the take-home points are that resistance is highly prevalent and increasing. You need an organism and sensitivities wherever possible, and don't rely on empiric treatment. Screen high-risk contacts. Do not use two-step testing for screening, but do just do a test 3 months after break-in contact. And refer resistant TB. And I've mentioned some of the TB team at the Hospital for Sick Children who I work with. In my view, managing children with disease, a team is a vital part of management. This includes a social worker, a nurse practitioner, physicians, nurses, translation services. I can't cope without an AT&T translation line that can give me every language in the world. And the public health nurses who are often attendees at our clinic and an integral part, they're the eyes and ears of the clinicians managing these children. I thank you for your time. I'll leave the last slide out, though it's an interesting thing to read for those who want to see where the future is heading.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Katai. That was outstanding. You covered an awful lot of ground in this lecture. You did it exceptionally well. I'll admit to being a little afraid at the last minute they wouldn't be able to fill the teleclass slot with a topic of real substance, but happily that wasn't the case. You gave us more than I had expected. Thank you very much. Ian, thanks so much for your time for this really fantastic teleclass lecture. I very much appreciate you making yourself available at this last minute. It's very good of you. Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for joining us on the lecture today. I look forward to speaking with you again very soon, and goodbye for now.